most regions of the United States these days, you could find cider for sale. But it wasn't always like that. At one time, there was not a single commercial cidery in the country. Now, I'm not talking pre-prohibition. I'm talking post-prohibition. In fact, not that long ago. There was a window of time between 1979 and 1984 when there was not a single commercial cider maker in the U.S. Now, you might hear that and think, oh, well, it was only a five-year period. That's not too long of a time when there wasn't a commercial maker. But you have to know the full story, because that other maker who stopped holding their license in 79 was S. Martinelli and Company, based out in Watsonville, California. And they had a huge market starting back in 1865, and then pretty much switched their entire production to creating apple juice, which is what they primarily do today. And they really weren't making any fermented products, what I call cider, and what pretty much the majority of the world calls cider. But of course, in America, we like to be different, so we call it hard cider too. And what's even more interesting about this story is that the U.S. government had no idea how to deal with cider. Unless you were a farmer, and there you could make cider, you could get an exemption to make cider, allowed to ferment by the wild yeast that were just out in your barn or your barrel, and let it go wild, which is a great way to make cider, but just to leave it like that would have really curtailed cider. And our guest this week, Judith Maloney, was going to have none of that. She was shooting to the moon. And the fact that we can now, in the U.S. of A., find cider in almost every corner of this nation today means that she reached the moon and even further. And in this here episode, we get to hear from Judith how she began her life in London, and then her family moved to California, and it was there that she met Terry Maloney and began making wine before doing a classic cross-country road trip to Western Massachusetts, where she and Terry, years later, launched West County Cider in 1984. Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. If, like me, you're really interested in the history of cider in America, check out the most recent episode on this topic titled How the Cider Teapot Fueled the American Revolution. And that was with Mark Tudor, who is a collection curator at the Museum of the American Revolution. And that's episode 317. And then there's also another episode with John Martinelli of S. Martinelli and Company, based in Watsonville, California, who in 1979 were the last folks in the U.S. to be making cider commercially. And that episode's going to be telling you the whole backstory on that. This episode with Judith Maloney is really tying into last week's episode with Paul Carenti. So if you're new to Cider Chat, you should really know that there is a rhyme and reason to everything I'm trying to do here on the podcast. And that is to give all of us an oral history, something that's going to be archived, hopefully forever, and to provide that oral history so we have a sense of place, where we came from, which is really tied into everything that we believe and love about cider and orchards and all the trees and people and community, both in my country, the United States, and the rest of the world. But right now, I'm really zoning into one particular region and its impact for the rest of the country, and that is Western Massachusetts and Massachusetts overall. And of course, that then spreads to New England, and then you kind of go from there. But I'm going to just primarily be focusing in on Western Mass, because in this year, 2022, Cider Chat is producing an event called Cider Days 2.0. Now, if you're part of Ciderville, if you've been in the cider community for any length of time, there's a really good chance that you've heard about Cider Days, which was founded in 1994. Paul Carenti and I spoke about it on last week's episode, and Judith and I will be talking about it on this here episode too. And starting back in 2015, when I first started producing Cider Chat, I would release a special episode each fall leading up to Cider Days, telling you out there in Ciderville how to attend this magnificent weekend event. You know, how to dress, what to bring, what to expect, etc., etc. And in 2019, we celebrated our 25th year, which is just amazing when you think about it. But then, of course, things kind of got a little off kilter for all of us during 2020 and 2021. And, you know, certainly we're still dealing with the schmutz, as I like to call it, of this stinking pandemic. But we are forging onward. And this November, I decided to basically try to kickstart Cider Days and bring back some of the key elements that we have lost over the years. So one thing we're going to be doing that we actually did in 2019 is we are kicking off the event on Friday night with a Calvados and an American brandy tasting. So that's going to be phenomenal. There's going to be 4 different Calvados and 2 American apple brandy. I'm over the moon for this. This is going to be amazing. So 6 different brandies to be tasting in essence. And all these events are going to be taking place at the Hawks and Reed Performing Arts Center in downtown Greenfield. And I will be presenting that guided tasting with my friend Ambrosia Borowski, who is based in Chicago and is both a cider and brandy expert. So I cannot wait for that. That's going to be the kickoff launch event for Cider Days 2.0. On Saturday, we have events in the morning. I'm going to hold that for now. But what I want to tell you is on Saturday night, we are bringing back the cider dinner. And you're going to be floored because there's going to be 6 producers. Let me go through this list because I kind of see 2022 is a very good year to bring back some amazing Pomona energy. We have Lisa Lairds-Dunn of Lairds & Company, which is the oldest distillery in the U.S. We have Judith Maloney representing West County Cider, our beloved Judith. It makes so much sense, doesn't it, to have the founder of Cider Days there. We're going to be having Eleanor Leger of Eden's Specialty Cider, that's based up in Vermont. We're going to have Louisa Spencer of Farnham Hill and Poverty Lane Orchards, based in New Hampshire. Yeah, another mega, mega OG of cider. We're going to have... I'm giddy, right? We're going to have Nicole Bloom of Carr's Cider House and Preservation Orchard and Farm in Hadley, Massachusetts. In fact, you're going to be hearing in an upcoming episode both an interview with she and her husband, Jonathan Carr. And then we're going to have Ann Garwood Hamp of Ragged Hill Cider out in West Brookfield, Massachusetts. So that is 6 women producers at this cider dinner on Saturday night. So we're going to have, you know, courses, and we'll start with a Lisa Lairds-Dunn cocktail. Oh, man, it's going to be, wow, I'm going to spontaneously combust just thinking about it. I'm just so stoked. So that's the Cider Days 2.0 events. I haven't even told you all of it. If you want to get info on the early ticket release, in fact, folks who are on this email list get the first dibs on tickets. And the first tickets to go live will be for that Calvados and American Apple Brandy tasting. Make sure that you sign up to the eCider News at ciderchat.com. So there'll be a link in the show notes to that. You could Google, you know, e-newsletter, whatever on Google, and you should get that no problem. Or if, you know, if you can't find that, just send an email to info@ciderchat.com. Say, I want to know about Cider Days 2.0, because you do not want to miss this. This is going to be, I mean, we are elevating the cider experience to the gonzo. And I haven't even told you what's going to be happening for the workshops yet. So stay tuned. All the events for Cider Days 2.0 are happening in downtown Greenfield, Massachusetts on the first weekend of November. Poof. We got a lot going on, a lot to look forward to, which means it's all on us to stay healthy and safe and keep our eye on the prize, which is always a full glass of cider or brandy, whatever you like, or both, right? All right. Well, hey, and I last thing I want to say that I appreciate you out there in Ciderville listening to Cider Chat each week, telling other people about it. And for all the patrons out there who support this podcast every single month, or the folks who hit the donate button, you are just unbelievable, because you keep this podcast on the air for so many people around the world who would like to know about these events. Maybe they can't attend them. So thank you to you, the listeners of Cider Chat, for trusting me and believing in me to be able to bring events like this and the French Cider Tour that's going out in just a couple weeks. I'm heading to France to do that, and to equally have the privilege to deliver to you nearly every week of this amazing life that we are leading all together, all as one unity around the world, talking good cider news. So thanks for that. I'm going to take a little pause here, and I will be right back. Up next is our featured conversation with Judith Maloney, who, along with her husband Terry Maloney, founded West County Cider back in 1984. I asked Judith to begin with a bit of her early beginnings, basically pre-Terry Maloney and even further back than that.
I was born in England, not too far from Chipping-Ongar Airfield, which my father, George Cavagnaro, helped build in World War II. It's on the northeast of London. My grandfather had a pub, and suddenly there were a lot of young American Air Force people. My mother and father got married in 1943. I was born in 1944. I think when my mother left England at the end of 1945, it was a great sadness and joy for her, but also it was I think the family knew that they would never be seeing each other because people didn't travel like they do nowadays. We lived in San Francisco in an area called Bayview, next to the San Francisco Naval Shipyards. We lived there until they tore it down because they decided it had too much
asbestos.
And then we ended up in Berkeley when I was in junior high school, which was, San Francisco and Berkeley were great places to come from. And there I met my husband, Terry, who had just gotten out of the Marines. I was serving food at UC Berkeley cafeteria, and he delivered the vegetables to me that I delivered to people.
Was he in school at that time?
Yeah, he did his
residency?
Medical. No, yeah. First is just his plain medical school training. He did that in 2 summers and 1 year. So,
wow, that's
quick. And then we and a bunch of medical students, we all moved to Sausalito. And that's when we started making wine.
Why Sausalito, of all places?
Why Sausalito? Because it was a big old Victorian house on one of the ledges over the bay. It had lots of rooms, and there were a lot of medical students in all those rooms. And it was 1967, so
wow,
it was an exciting time. We got a bunch of old equipment from our landlord, and we made quite a lot of wine.
And so you would get the grapes from local
Well, we
California?
Got the grapes because when I was a teenager, I became the neighborhood babysitter. And I babysat for someone who had 4 kids, and their best friend was Rene De Rosa, who started Winery Lake in the Carneros. They'd go up there every weekend and help Rene, and I took care of the kids. We got grapes from Rene because Rene wasn't using his grapes because the grape strike and Cesar Chavez.
Here's a little perspective on what Judith is talking about. In 1960, Renee purchased 460 acres of land in the Caneros region in Napa Valley. So obviously, he had grapevines going on there, and he was really well known for his winery called Winery Lake Vineyard, and he was producing both Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And around the same time, around 1965, the grape strike was led by Mexican-American civil rights activist Cesar Chavez, who was asking Americans to boycott California fruit because of, one, the pay and the poor working conditions for the agricultural laborers who were basically had no other choice but to endure these difficulties. So that's what was happening then. Let's go back to this conversation.
So he was happy to have us. They were Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Wow. Was that the first time that you guys were making wine? Was at that house in Sausalito?
Yeah.
Wow. And all the medical students were in on it too, so.
Oh, we made a lot of cider. Well, I mean, a lot of wine.
I know. Interchangeable there.
Interchangeable. Yeah, so anyway, wow. We did that. And we kept on making wine. When we moved to San Francisco, we had a little house that was owned by the University of San Francisco Medical Center.
Do you remember what road that was on that you lived
yeah,
on?
Yeah, it was 4th Avenue.
Okay.
So Terry and I, we had a tub that you could squash the grapes with your feet.
And that's what you did.
That was very much fun.
Yeah.
And we didn't make as much as we made in Sausalito, but there weren't as many people drinking. Mm. Then when Terry finished all his medical this and that, he had some time off, so he'd had enough of studying, I'd say that, and working all the time. And I was working at the post office. Mm. And then I got a teaching credential, and I was working in Oakland as a substitute teacher. We could have stayed in California. It was my home. Mm. I did have family. Mm. I mean, cousins and so on. But instead, we got into an old school bus and we came here to Massachusetts because
like a camper bus.
It was called a stubby. It was truly a school bus.
A school bus that was like a camper, though, that you converted into a camper, or it still had all the seats in it?
No, I didn't have the seats.
Okay, so you kind of camped your way across the country to Massachusetts.
Yeah, we did. We came here because one of our friends was here in Shelburne Falls. So it was like, oh, adventure. So we went cross-country. It took a lot of time with all the breakdowns we had. And we ended up here. And it was very beautiful because it was near fall foliage. And there was the beautiful rivers, the Deerfield. And you could get in an inner tube and go sailing down. And we decided, okay, we'll stay here for a year. And we've been here since then.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So that's just what happens.
Yeah.
And I had Field Maloney in 1973. Yeah. I really got into reading about agricultural history from the past, old books. There were a lot of libraries getting rid of their oldest books. And I thought it was really interesting, a time when people made their own things, had horses and so on and so forth, and made their own cider. They made their own entertainment and their own way of getting through the winter. I thought, oh, this is very interesting. We got to do this. So we had brought an apple cider press with us.
From California.
It was from up near Santa Cruz, actually.
No kidding. From the hill towns of Santa Cruz?
One of the hill towns.
Oh, my goodness.
Or I think it was Los Gatos, but that's almost Santa Cruz.
Well, yeah. And so it actually had the grinder to grind the apples. It wasn't a wine press.
No, it was a...
Well, that makes sense. I mean, that was...
They had a lot of apples. Major apples.
Aptos, that's right. Yeah. Aptos, Watsonville.
Yep. Yeah. People we knew in town. They made their own cider. They all had their favorite trees. So we had to try that. I realized that we could probably get a winery license to make hard cider. So I went through all the process, including seeing a BATF agent and so on and so forth. They didn't want us to get a winery license for cider. They didn't have, of course, a cider license. They wanted us to just do it on the farmer's exemption, which at that point it was like, you can make a gallon, you can use a plastic jug, and you just let it ferment, and that's it. You couldn't state the apple
that was being used.
It was not like making wine, and it didn't stand for the same things that making wine stood for, which is the taste. This is how the BATF thought of it. It wasn't a question of taste. It wasn't a question of provenance or where the apples came from. It was missing some really major things that we thought were important to state.
Mm-hmm.
But so we went ahead and got a winery license because there was no, they didn't have a cider license.
No other option, yeah. Were you always working like with one particular agent? And you're saying
yes, his name was Giuliani.
Giuliani?
Yes, he was.
Related to
Ernie
the mayor?
Ernie Giuliani, he was mostly into firearms.
Uh-huh.
But this was, he liked coming out.
And visiting you in Coleraine. So, and I just want our listeners to know, Judith is talking about the BATF, and you're talking about the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which
right.
is the regulatory division in the U.S. here for...
Right, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. So Giuliani was out there telling you what to do.
He was not, he said he wasn't related to the famous Giuliani.
Yeah, at the time, who knows, but...
But you know the Italians, they have so many children. I should say that as a Cavagnaro.
Exactly.
I'm a Cavagnaro.
There you go. You became commercial in 84, so how long did it take for that process? Do you remember?
I think it took a year,
within
a year.
Okay.
I had to go down to their headquarters in Rhode Island to, you know, show them all kinds of paperwork. Mm-hmm. I couldn't just, and then he started coming to our house after that. We got equipment because in 1983 was the Massachusetts Dairy Buyout Program. In where they were trying to see about having fewer dairy farmers, because at that point there were a lot of small farmers still. The only good thing I will say about that is it allowed us to get a lot of stainless steel equipment.
The milk tanks, which could be like 100,
right.
150 gallons,
yeah.
maybe up to 300, and you were actually able to get that because your cidery was in the basement of your home.
That's right, it was in the basement.
Was there like a walk-out way to enter into that?
Yeah,
because
we lived down there for the first year and a half, building the house on top.
Did you actually build it yourself, the home?
Yeah. Well, we did the post and beams. We lived in the basement using the adz and the axes. And all that.
So you did all the posts and beams.
We did all the posts and beams.
My goodness. So you're pretty much a classic Western masser, you know, homesteader, where
exactly.
we're all
yes.
building, you know,
yes.
living in yurts and
yes.
living in whatever we can, you know, off the grid, no running water. I mean, how long did it take to get running water at the site?
Well, it took a while to get running water, too. The first we had a dowser coming.
Yeah.
And he said, there's going to be water here. Well, there was some water there.
Mm.
We brought water from a spring up on the hill. One of our neighbors gave us the rights to the spring. The spring went underground from his land down to our land, and that's been going ever since.
This is on Catamount Mountain.
Catamount Hill,
which is in Coleraine, and it's kind of like one of those places that you can't get there from here. Easy to get lost on the winding roads. It's up a bit, and the actual home itself, you kind of pull in, and it's on the side of a hill, because it's Catamount Hill.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that you probably had to clear that land, or was there any kind of open when you got it?
No, we cleared the land.
Yeah, which now has...
That's what we did those 10 years before we started making cider and got a license. And yeah. Having a child.
Right.
And yeah. So that was... Yes, I sometimes think, well, I could have been a teacher. That would have been cool. I always was really interested in children knowing how to read and knowing the alphabet. I think that... And reaching out into the world through books. Who knows what I could, what could have been, but this is what was.
Mm.
So then we started doing cider. We started out like 150 gallons with the one tank, and then it was two tanks, and then we brought in some 500-gallon tanks. It's interesting. So there's a dairy buyout program. They get rid of the small farmers. Then they have... some kind of crisis with apples down in Connecticut where somebody got sick on sweet cider.
Oh, sweet cider, the kind of classic thing where it was not...
Yes. So then bacteria. Massachusetts yeah. creates a license to make sweet cider to have a press. So the people who were making small amounts of sweet cider along with selling their apples, a lot of them gave up.
It was too much for them to continue, huh?
Yeah, they weren't they couldn't make enough money to make it worthwhile. Mm.
And there was really no kind of pasteurization at that point. Now we're like we'll see UV.
Well, if anybody
used.
Some people did that, but in doing that, that was money that some of these small farmers up there in the hills didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another source of apples.
And equipment.
There was some really good old apples from that. We were making farm cider, which was absolute without sulfite. And then the other ones we made had sulfite. But we were able to get some interesting apples. And at the same time, I had friends in France. So we knew of some of the cider apples. We didn't know what they tasted like. And we didn't know what the English ones tasted like. So we grew... like a line of these different apples. I mean, we weren't big, but we were very intentional, I guess you'd say.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that in the United States still, there's that sense with cider that you might not be big, because we certainly weren't, but you were interested in apples and their evolution in America, because it's a very evolved apple culture as it works its way west and it has all these different climates and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. When you were starting to make cider, you got your commercial license, you're getting your sourcing from Pine Hill, David Shear's orchard there up in Coleraine. Was there
And we were growing these. We were growing too. We were growing Rendapom, Dabinet.
Was this before you got the Redfield?
We started Redfield because we connected with
the Geneva.
Geneva with Cornell.
Research, yeah.
And there was a man there, eager. His name was Frank Labelle, and Frank Labelle had been to France. And he had some of the tastes frozen in his freezer in his house. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'd have little tastings of these weird apple tastes. They'd be very tannic.
And red. A Redfield apple is
a
red flesh.
Oh, the Redfield apple is, if we're talking about Redfield apples, there was a historic apple orchard at Cornell, which... After that, they cut down part of it and they cryo-froze the germ...
plasma, whatever
plasma,
it is.
Whatever it's
yeah.
called.
Yeah.
He wanted us to grow the Redfield so that we would... He knew that soon there wouldn't be any. who knew what was going to happen with that orchard? It was good for it to reach into the community.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of classic what happens with universities. They'll have a student or a PhD student or a department kind of growing an orchard. And you'd be like, oh my God, there's a beautiful orchard. And then a new research project will come in and they'll just wipe it out, you know, which has happened here with UMass too.
Yeah.
University of Massachusetts. So that's interesting. So the Redfield was there and he was concerned. And here...
And then Terry started making cider with it. I mean, we brought some juice home, made cider with it, and we thought, whoa, this is tannic, fruity, and beautiful.
Yes, really beautiful cider. And you've kind of, I mean, West County cider has really made the Redfield famous.
Well, yeah, we did a lot of sharing. Mm-hmm. With other people giving them cyan
wood to graft their own.
Yeah.
And now, like, there's a cider boutique store
called
and
Redfield.
Bar. Called Redfield.
In Oakland. California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How poetic.
They called us to see. I think she was calling us to see if we had copyright on it. The other thing that we didn't have on Catamount Hill until about 6 months ago was Wi-Fi. So
until,
you know,
6 months ago in 2020.
Yes.
2022, I'm sorry.
2022.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes out here. We're kind of recent,
yes,
too.
So Terry used it sometimes, but so we had dial-up, which was through our telephone. We weren't savvy to that world, and I'm still not savvy to that world, though I should be, but my son is. Somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's going at, you know, sonic pace,
yes,
so it's really hard to keep up with it.
Yes.
So you're doing all the business, I think what you're getting at, you're doing all the business out of your home in Coleraine with dial-up, which, you know, is that like slow motion type of...
Yeah, so I did the selling, and I decided, first we had it at our house, but nobody knew where our house was. And that was just as well, actually, because... But Pine Hill built a little house that we had the tasting room there for 13 years.
Yeah.
But, and we were only open on weekends. But I was trying to do it in the local area. The local area wasn't so much into local is great as it is today. People didn't always know why we would be doing apples when we could be trying to make local wine.
And there wasn't really, like, grapes were kind of being grown around here, but the Canadian
grapes and so on.
I suppose.
I mean, the ones that are good in the north.
Yeah.
They were being experimented with then too.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was in California with Terry. He didn't come out to California very often because he was busy. He was an ER doctor. I considered cider that was our business.
Mm-hmm.
So in California, through friends, there was a winery called Duck Soup. DUXOUP. And he told me, he was friends of a friend. He told me he was filling his truck up and going to San Francisco, because you had to do a one-on-one if you were going to make something work. People had to know who you were. There had to be a relationship, a connection. You always need a relationship.
Yeah, not over the phone.
Not over the phone. And how are you going to do tastings?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the other thing he said was you should be within 150 miles of where you were going to try to sell, because you didn't want to have to drive all around. So that was perfect for going to Boston.
He was really recommending that you self-distribute versus sign up for the distributor.
And you're allowed to self-distribute.
Yeah.
So I went to Boston, and I got some orders. Then I wrote a letter to a bunch of different restaurants. Well, there was one called Daddy-O's, and then there was Jasper White. At first, he would only want my vinegar, because I was also making vinegar. I mean, he was like, oh, you make the best vinegar. It's like, that isn't what I wanted to hear.
Oh, boy.
But, you know, after a while, I'd leave his maître d', or whatever they call the guy who is kind of running the business side of the show and is there a lot. He got Jasper to take it.
How about New York? Did New York?
We had a distributor in New York, and that was good for... He'd buy pallets at a time, so that was good. And, they, you know, people liked the cider because we started making these smaller batches of just the kind of apples that we were interested in, that we'd been growing. And then, so they'd be dominant of a certain apple, and then mm-hmm. We'd back it with some of the local apples. Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, so your bottles were all like crown cap bottles. Was that true?
Yeah, and then we got a corker from some champagne business that was going out of business in around Buffalo, and Terry's from Buffalo. So when we went there, we got that machine. It looked fancier.
Looked fancier and kind of like upscale, even though the crown cap was totally fine.
Yeah, totally basically. Fine. I mean, I do.
So some of those early ciders, like the Baldwin, was just coveted by folks.
There were people who would buy a case of this and that and this and that. And then there was some called Roxbury Russet.
Mm-hmm.
And the Roxbury was interesting because... someone in the Historical Society who wanted us to name the cider after this man who had died and whose father had had an orchard and had actually died falling off of a ladder from a tree. But anyway.
My goodness. But you decided not to.
We decided not to.
Okay. Well, maybe a good idea, not to go
Roxbury,
there.
And then somebody... called me from Roxbury. We had a liquor store in Roxbury, and he was the janitor at a school in Roxbury, and he thought that they had a Roxbury apple tree. So right. I sent him a bunch of our apples to Roxbury
to see if it matched.
And he never got back in touch with me. But maybe there is a true tree
right.
lurking at a private school in Roxbury.
Yeah, because we're looking at like 16 something, I think, when the
that was the was earliest. It's theoretically the earliest named apple in America.
Yeah,
I mean, at least in Massachusetts.
Yeah, for sure. What were you kind of getting a sense of, like folks making cider locally? Like there was Valley Fermenters and things like that. But were you in touch with like a lot of the farmers who were putting up barrels? Because I know I've been to
Hager's
at your home.
Well, yeah. Hager's put up barrels. We were our dairy neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Just for their own, use.
Oh, yes.
And then fortifying. I mean, there was, some neighbors really fortifying.
They were really strong.
Yeah. And when I mean fortified, just for folks listening, that's where people will use a barrel that might have had some spirit in it, and there was still some spirit in it, so you're getting that overture in the cider. And then some folks would have a barrel, a spirit barrel, and then add a pint of this or that or even more.
Like vodka.
Vodka? I didn't know vodka.
Oh, yes, vodka. Wow. Vodka was a cheap.
I could see that, but I thought it was more something like... whiskey or something like that.
Well, what's the difference between whiskey and... I mean, it's all alcohol.
Yeah, well, that's true, but it has a different taste.
The idea was that it was high octane, mm-hmm. and that was one of its jobs, mm-hmm. to be high octane.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people... A lot of it was high octane, and it was not even... It was pleasant only if you added fruit juice back to it.
Right, to, like, water it down. Did you know Dewey, who was, like, a renowned...
I didn't know Dewey, but I went to Dewey's.
Oh, you did. So just a little bit of the backstory here. And Dewey was...
In Haydenville,
in Massachusetts.
He grew an apple orchard.
And would make cider and sell it out of... how was that set up?
Because that was using the cider exemption where you use plastic. I don't even know if you using the natural yeast. I can't remember. I mean, I certainly never asked Dewey what kind of yeast he used.
Right. We didn't talk about that kind of stuff back then.
No. It's more like he looked at you and decided how old you were. uh-huh. and what you wanted it for, whether you were going to have a party.
All right.
I mean, it was like...
Wow.
So, yeah, whenever you come across somebody who got cider from Dewey's, nowadays, they're older. Mm. Did you know Dewey?
No, I did not. But I do have a glass jug from Dewey's with a Dewey label on it.
That, oh, cool.
You know, I picked up in one of the hill towns here.
Yeah, that's
folks
cool.
Folks didn't even know, like, what it was. I was like, oh, my gosh, that's a Dewey gallon jug. But I know that he would, like, sell cider to kids, and it would be slightly a little
effervescent.
Bit,
yes.
A little effervescent.
Well, he had the in theory, I mean, I can't say this was so, but in theory, the sweeter ones were up near where you came in, and then the drier, stronger ones were down below.
Down below.
Because he had two floors. We'd get it to go to our friends in Conway who had a sauna along the river. So it's like...
Ah, a little party cider.
It was party cider.
Very cool.
But it wasn't necessarily delicious, I have to say.
Uh-huh. Of course.
I think one of the things that I was really taken by in Coleraine was that they, when you started talking to them, they'd sell maple syrup and hard cider down in Turner's Falls, which is also was very French-Canadian mm-hmm. for the paper mills. I thought cider, I felt as though it was like, you know, like communion. I thought that being given a bottle of cider or being given a glass of cider in Coleraine meant something. It meant something to me. I felt as though I was in the community. Even before we started making cider, mm-hmm. it was one of the reasons I wanted to make cider.
Right.
And I mean, and then we did this thing that that Rhea knows about. We all started the Cider Day event, and I think that one of the powers of that event was that it had the sense of being a community and almost being a sacrament, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, you know...
Yeah, it's like always, here, try this. It
yes,
was just so giving
yes,
and so
yes.
welcoming, and everybody was on the same playing field.
Yeah, so I think those were really important. I needed a community. We needed a community. Mm-hmm. And this, we had a community that was made of this connection to apples mm-hmm. and pressing and neighbors, mm-hmm. you know. It.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I think that a lot of cider makers have that connection.
Yes, I would agree.
Because there's something about it that is still, it's very old, but it's also experimental.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're dealing with something, the apple, which in theory a tree can take care of itself, but it likes to be cared for. Yeah, I think that is really, it makes you part of the natural world too.
So let's talk a little bit about the community. You mentioned Cider Day, which is actually Cider Days, but the first year it was one single day.
Right.
It was, I don't know how many years it was like as one day, and then all of a sudden it went up to 2 days. And then this community that kind of pulled to help start that first Cider Days with the cider making workshops. From your vantage point, were you surprised to see Cider Days take off to the degree it did? You know, in 2019, we celebrated 25 years of Cider Days.
You know, you get people interested in something, and they come. Albert Hager always, so he came to the first one we had at Pine Hill, and they cleared out some tractors and put some seats in there.
In the barn.
In the barn. So Albert Hager was, he brought some cider and he lifts up this muck And he says, when it starts looking like snot, then you know that it's really going.
Oh my
goodness. That's sort of like, that grabbed a lot of people. But
I'm sure it did. not necessarily in a good way.
But anyway, it grabbed people. And people were able, so Pine Hill started selling 5-gallon carboys. People would go down. Yeah. And then there started to be cider makers. And of course Paul must have talked about that.
Yeah. Well, we didn't talk about the actual picking up, and which they still do today. They sell bulk juice to home cider makers, and now the line is like down the road.
I know.
And much more organized.
And that is that people come to see each other. That's the secret.
That's the secret sauce.
It's become That is a community there.
Yeah, yeah.
They're
yeah.
so happy to see each other every year.
Right, right.
Until COVID. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. COVID kind of stopped it, but we're coming back this year.
Yes, COVID made it so that it was like suddenly we were all given a pause to figure out what should happen. I think.
Yeah, well, sometimes a pause is a good thing.
A pause is a great thing.
Yeah.
That's what Buddhists all say, right?
Yep, that's right.
Just breathe.
Exhale into is how I approach life.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think Terry would say about where cider is now in 2022? I mean, he died in 2010.
Yeah.
12 years ago. And it was kind of like, I felt like the air go out of like everyone when that happened. And I know, especially you. At that point, we saw it was beginning of magnificent growth for cider.
Right.
It was really starting to kick off and going up to like 2016, like magnificent growth. And now here we are where you could go most places in the U.S.
And find cider.
Maybe more than one brand, because way back when, I mean, when you and Terry started, you were the only cidery, and then it became kind of like enough cideries to count on one hand, then two hands.
Well, of course, we're talking Steve Woods, Poverty Lane.
He was right behind, right next to us. Yeah,
he started, and he probably started growing the trees. Well, his grandfather.
They had trees way before that, yeah. But he didn't start making cider for a while. And I remember those early ciders from Steve. He was really making kind of like funky, farm ciders.
Edgy.
That's a good way to say it.
I like edgy. I think it's really important to play
on the edge.
Play on the edge sometimes.
So getting back to that question, because you knew Terry so well, what do you think he would think about where we are today? Would he, were you both kind of seeing it grow back then?
Oh, yeah, we were seeing it grow.
I mean, obviously, cider days were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger back then.
We were seeing it grow, and I think he would be delighted, especially since it keeps us going and keeps my son going.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have been kicked out of liquor stores because they're all using cans now, and they won't touch a 750.
Uh-huh.
Apart from that, maybe by then, I don't know if he would have gone to cans, truthfully.
Everyone looks to West County Cider.
As the past? As part of the past, I think so.
Part of the past? I kind of see it as a foundation.
Yeah, I like that.
The foundation of kind of the pillar for holding up where we are today in modern America at this point in time. You really paved the path for all of us.
I think us and Steve at Poverty Orchard.
Yeah, you want to say more? Why Steve?
Because Steve had a vision that was, Steve has a vision, and he created it.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
And
he's still rocking, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely rocking.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Steve for a while. He connected to slow foods. He mm-hmm. went to Italy with mm-hmm. his sons, and mm-hmm. he really reached out to the larger mm-hmm. world. Mm. And also, when Terry was, when we lost Terry, Steve came every day for like, I don't know, 2 weeks from New Hampshire to help with keeping the cider, bottling the cider. Because it had all been made. We had 3,000 gallons made and filtered, and we had to bottle it. And Steve came down every day. I can't thank him enough. But also, he and Terry would get on the phone. Steve can talk.
Yes, he can.
And he and Terry made a good couple.
They would go back at it.
Yeah. I think they really loved each other.
Yeah. I think it's kind of hard to encapsulate what West County Cider is and what it was and where it's going. But it is undeniable that it is kind of like, what I like to say, it's like the shot that was heard. You know, it's like the bottle cap that was opened around the world that was heard, because it's so far reaching. And I see you as a very unpretentious person. I don't think you probably even get the amount of admiration that people have for you.
Well, that's because you've been having the cider chat, and you keep it alive, and for that I am very thankful.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that, but I get inspired by you. And I want to say, one of the ways I always get most inspired by you, like the first time, was at Cider Days, way back. It'd be at a dinner. And all of a sudden, you know, all this noise. And then you'd swing up a chair and get yourself on top of this chair and you know, pull the group together and make, you know, some kind of speech.
And a song.
And a song, which was?
The song that I really got into was The Rainbow.
Rainbow Connection.
Yes.
From Sesame Street.
From Sesame Street.
Yeah.
Oh, da, 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 da. Songs about rainbows and what's on the other side. Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. And rainbows have nothing to hide. Some people say, I choose to believe it. Just wait and see. Someday you'll find it. The rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Ya da 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 da.
That was Judith Maloney, who, along with her husband Terry Maloney, founded West County Cider back in 1984. If you'd like to hear a conversation with her son Field Maloney, go to episode 1 of Cider Chat. There'll be a link in the show notes to that. If you would like to meet Judith Maloney and other fantastic women cider producers who have done so much to elevate cider for all, do consider coming to the cider dinner that's going to be taking place on November 5th at the Hawks and Reeds Performing Arts Center in downtown Greenfield. Sign up now for the eCider News to get early release tickets for that upcoming dinner and more. And also make sure to follow Cider Chat and all its different social media channels and the I Love Cider Days Facebook page, where events will be posted along with links to tickets. As we all join in rebooting this beloved yearly Cider Fest and educational experience. I sure hope to see you then. But for now, I leave you here. This is Rio Wind Caller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Strange apples, bitter sharp. Strange apples, juicy and ripe. Bop, 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 ba-da-boom, doo-doo-da, bop, bop, bop. ba-da-boom, doo-doo-dop. Who wants a tanning balm?
I want a tanning balm.
Who wants to pull them down?
I'm gonna pull them down. Hey, 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 apples, bittersweet.
Apples
hanging high,
got them strange apples.
Forget the pie,
strange apples,
squeeze them tight.
Got them strange
apples, strange apples. Apples, make them pop. Pop, 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 ba-da-boom, doo-dee-dop. Pop, 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 ba-da-boom, doo-dee-dop. Who wants a tanning balm?
I want a tanning balm.
Who wants to pull them down?
I'm gonna pull them down. Hey, 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 apples,
come and see. Plenty strange apples for you and me. Strange apples, strange apples, strange apples, make them pop.
Pop, pop, pop,
ba da doo doo da, pop, pop. Pop, ba-da, doo-dee-da, pop, 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 ba-da, doo-dee-da, pop, 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 pop,
yee-haw!